culture is really nothing more than however we've been socialized as individuals. So we think about all the layers of socialization, our family, our education, our profession, our faith, where in the country or in the world we've lived. All of these are socializing elements that enable us to see the world through our limbic systems, our initial responses to how we observe each other and also the situations that we walk into.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Learn It All podcast. We are Damon Lemby and Darren Bridget. Damon Lemby, CEO of Learn It, Darren Bridget, VP of the product here at Learn It. We are joined by a very special guest today, Paula Caligiuri. I'm super impressed with myself for saying that correctly. Paula, I'm going to list your resume as best I can because it's pretty impressive. You can correct me. Distinguished professor at Northeastern University, co-founder of Skillify, prolific author, a recent book, which is Live for a Living and also Build Your Cultural Agility. We'll be talking a lot about cultural agility today. You may have seen her on CNN. She's got courses on LinkedIn Learning, recognized influential person in the international scene for organizational psychology. And that just doesn't even begin to touch all of the letters that show up after your name and the credentials that you have. Paula, welcome to our podcast.
Darren, Damon, thank you for the invitation. It's going to be great.
Yeah, well, we're really excited to have you here. And I think for those of our listeners who are tuning in, some of the things that you could expect to get out of this episode is just a much deeper understanding of how to navigate this international global world that we live in when it comes to business. And that's certainly true with internationally, but even cultural in the largest sense. How do we all just really work together more efficiently, as well as some really great ideas development? So Paula, we start with a question here that we give to everybody because we're all about learning here. So what are you hoping to learn in the next 6 months or so? Something that you'd like to learn and get better at coming up in the near future?
Oh, wow. Absolutely. Social media marketing. I'm learning so much from individuals who are helping us with the book, with Live for a Living, about social media marketing. And it's not really ever been something I've had to do. So I'm learning and happy to do
it. Damon, you've had to do quite a bit of that recently too, I think.
I am. And Paula, are you focusing on LinkedIn or just across the board?
Actually, they told me to get on with the publisher, the marketing folks, said I needed to get on Instagram. So that's pretty new for me and I'm trying it.
Good for you. When I came out with my book, I was barely on Instagram and I was told the same thing. So now I'm out there and a lot of my buddies are like, what is all these videos of you and everything you're doing? You just have to get out there and go for it. And I think it's important and valuable.
Yeah. I'm trying, right? Same thing.
Good. Yeah. There's always new stuff to learn. That certainly feels like an area with a lot of learning opportunities. Paula, can you give us a little bit of a background? You really have become an internationally recognized expert when it comes to this idea of cultural agility. And I think we'll get into what exactly that means as we go. But how did you arrive at this path?
Sure. My story actually goes back to the 80s. I'm not going to make it too long, but I was studying abroad in Rome. The market crashed. I didn't have any money. My parents said, sweetheart, you have two choices. You can either come home or get a job. So I decided I needed to get a job in Rome. While the other American kids were running around Europe, I was staying in Italy, visiting relatives, had an Italian boyfriend, all the things that Americans do while they're abroad. But when I returned back to finish out my junior year of college, I was working in the psychology department. And my advisors at the time said, Paula, what's wrong with you? You seem sad, mopey, depressed. We now know of that as repatriation adjustment. Back then, we didn't know really what it was. And they said, look, if that had such a profound influence on your life, the experience in Italy, why don't you study it? So my graduate school applications in 1989 said, I want to study what makes people effective living and working internationally, and I want to know how they change from deep developmental cross-cultural experiences. That was decades ago, and I'm still studying what makes people effective living and working internationally and how they change from deep developmental cross-cultural. I'm just now doing it with the military, the Peace Corps, the public sector firms, large multinationals, small companies, and everything in between.
I have to say, the idea of leaving Italy after 3 years in the 80s, I would be depressed just hearing that. I think that's a natural reaction.
Well, I do get to go back.
And your Italian is probably really good, or at least at the time, I bet it was, yeah?
Back then it was. Now I would say probably not so great.
All right, okay. So cultural agility, that for you, it was a very personal experience from when you started and you moved forward because you really understood the power of culture. And I imagine along the way, there was so much for you to learn and adjust to, and then coming back. And from your point of view, cultural agility is really the way to focus on this. This is how you really work internationally. This is how we get along, even just thinking about the cultural differences that we have anywhere, even just locally, there's going to be cultural differences. It's almost like the key to collaboration. Why do you see it so much about cultural agility, as opposed to, say, for example, unconscious bias training or the other ways that people might like?
And what is cultural agility?
Yeah. That's a much better way to ask that question. I could just say simply, what is cultural agility?
I can start with that, but I want to answer the unconscious bias training question too, because it's cultural agility is really the ability to comfortably and effectively work in different countries and with people from different cultures. But culture is really nothing more than however we've been socialized as individuals. We think about all the layers of socialization, our family, our education, our profession, our faith, where in the country or in the world we've lived. All of these are socializing elements that enable us to see the world through our limbic systems, our initial responses to how we observe each other and also the situations that we walk into. I am not a fan of unconscious bias training, and I'm so sorry, but what we see in research is that what unconscious bias training is doing is essentially just, it's heightening everyone's awareness of their limbic processors, which is great. So we all have knee-jerk reactions based on the data we've been collecting our entire lives. But what it's not doing effectively is it's not telling us how to override that and how to actually use our brains, our prefrontal cortex, to really have these authentic and real conversations with one another. So all of that is okay. My fear with unconscious bias training, what it's doing is it keeps flagging for people what their quote unquote, I hate the phrase, but biases are. And in doing so, it's stopping those organic and authentic conversations that we would normally embrace having with one another. So sorry, that was a really winded answer for what it is and why it's different.
I think it was shorter than the question, the way I asked it. So it basically, you're like charting a path forward. And this is something that we see with people out there doing really good work about building more empathy and understanding about the differences. And they could be generational, they could be gender, they could be race. There's all kinds of things in addition to different nationalities. But then people, what ends up happening is they get afraid to talk to each other. They don't know how to interact anymore. And so you're presenting a path forward to, let's recognize these differences, but here's how we can now move forward and actually work together. Can you tell us a little bit about what your recommendations are?
Sure. So, Darren, what you describe, all that wonderful training that kind of understanding generational differences and national differences and professional differences, gender, whatever the differences might be, that's actually one part of cultural agility. Our brains have to be aware that something could potentially be different, right? Mm-hmm. We have to be signaled to have that opportunity to see a difference. But then there's the other piece of it. That now what do you do with that, right? And what we're finding, and the reason I wrote the cultural agility book, is that individuals who have a set of competencies tend to be able to read that environment, read that interaction, read that situation accurately and respond as needed. And those competencies are things like tolerance of ambiguity, resilience, because you're going to make some mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Perspective taking, humility, curiosity, relationship building. Those are the critical competencies that enable us to be great anywhere, whether we're your pharmaceutical sales rep selling to a foreign-born healthcare provider, or if you're a Peace Corps volunteer working in another country. It doesn't matter. It's always about that ability to go into a situation, recognize that something could be different in the way you establish trust, build credibility, communicate, and then use those competencies in order to really be the best in those situations.
I got to follow. So that sounds really interesting. I'd love to get into some of the ways that you break up the differences too, because you could talk about self-management, relationship management, and task management, which I think is interesting. But let me just see if I got this right, because the idea with a bias is that I'm a cognitive miser. So my brain has to work this way, that I have these things that just happen unconsciously. That's part of the deal. But what you're talking about in terms of these competencies that you develop, do you try to train them so that they become automatic, like a tonic for the biases that you might have? Or do you use it like you're always bringing it to your prefrontal cortex and just like, here's my checklist, remember to do the checklist?
Yeah, it's a teeny bit of both. So you're absolutely right. What we do is we train on each of those competencies. So if you think about each of those competencies has its own recipe. Some of it is how your body's wired, how your body's handled serotonin and dopamine and the like. And then a good portion of each competency is really skills that you can learn and build and develop and gain in order to move the needle on any given competence, whether it's tolerance, ambiguity, resilience, perspective taking. All of them have this formula, if you will. Everybody is a little bit different in how they mix the ingredients, but those are the ingredients. To some extent, it is just straight out building the competencies, because once you build up those, you can go into situations realizing that you're going to judge a situation instinctively. We all do, right? In a fraction of a second. But when you have those competencies, you're able to do things like, let's see, tolerance of ambiguity enables you to linger longer in a state of uncertainty. So rather than making these reflexive, subjective impressions, having that competency enables you to go into a situation and realize you don't have information. Humility enables you to go into a situation and say, look, no matter how brilliant I am as a chemist, a IT professional, a journalist, whatever, you need to learn how to do it there. But it enables you to go into a situation and rather than reflexively reacting to students or clients or lab mates or whatever in a certain way, you're willing to say, I need to learn how to do it here. So each one of the competencies has a role in enabling people to learn how to override those reflective responses and those subjective impressions.
Yeah, that's great.
When I was researching a little bit for our conversation today, I heard you speaking about the importance of, like you said, holding back judgment and also the importance of building trust and empathy as part of the competencies. And that's a question we get asked a lot. Where do we start? If we want to build a better culture or whatever we want to do, where would you recommend a team leader start in building trust with his or her team?
Yeah, trust is interesting because even the construct is culturally bound and meaning that each kind of evaluate whether we're going to trust someone in a slightly different way. So just in a work context, some people trust based on competence. Show me you're really good at what you do and I'll trust that I can work with you because I trust that you'll do what you say you're going to do or that you're dependable or reliable. Other people, trust comes on that interpersonal sense. Become my friend. Let's connect. Let's tell me about your family, your life, your background. And then we can work together because now I trust you as a person. So if I were a team leader going into a multicultural team, and this is usually the advice we have to give to multicultural team leaders, is you have to assume all of those are true. So you have to spend some time credentializing everyone, giving everybody each other's credibility, at the same time, leaving some space and some room for getting to know one another. We have a few tools that we use to help team leaders do that a little more efficiently. But it's the recognizing that it's not one size fits all. And then another part is just leaving some space for the team to operate effectively and understanding that their styles will be different and all that other good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a learned alumni who is leading a team, Salesforce actually, out in Europe. And she has team members and team leads in Italy, France, all different European countries. And she said it's incredible how the cultural differences in each one. And so she's trying to learn. She asked me, she said, she's trying to learn. Sarah, she said, just trying to learn how to deal with each different region has been incredibly challenging and a great learning opportunity for her. It's all different everywhere she goes. It's for the first time.
And it's impressed. Kudos to her that she's recognizing that she can't be the same leader exactly the same way. That's actually why when I coined the phrase cultural agility, that's why I called it agility, right? It's, you have to change your form without losing your balance.
One of the questions we get sometimes is essentially like, how do I know? So if I'm a new leader and you're my team. So Damon, are you more task-based trust or relationship-based trust? And how do you actually find out across these different dimensions the ways that people might be different?
Yeah, we do some assessments ahead of time that when I had said this is a way to shortcut for leaders, like your colleague, we have some assessments that enable them to see their team on a grid and actually see where everyone is and how they might differ. So there's some assessments you could do. There's also some kind of logical questions. Hey, tell me about people you trusted in the past. And
We can
add it to the show notes. Are the assessments online? They go to your website and find them or contact you directly for that?
Yeah, in fact, they're free. So that's the other benefit. We're a public benefit corporation and Skillify is your name. And one of the goals was to try to get most of this content out there as broadly as possible. So we can get a lot of great information for free.
That's brilliant. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
You're not sure. My guide, but I can send you there.
Good. One of the challenges that we have when it comes to people, things like humility or empathy, I mean, we work on these things and people want to get better at them, but it's a little hard to know how to make it actionable. As opposed to if somebody wants to be a better coach, here's specific questions you could ask, for example. Or if you want to get better at giving feedback, here's a formula you could follow. But if you want to get better at humility or empathy, like what do you do?
So we use this exercise because there's usually of the ones I'll name, there's usually one that's tougher than others for each person. And that's one they have to work on. So they have to work on praising others, on learning from others, especially people who you perceive to be more junior than you, and then learn to appreciate others. And it's fascinating when I do this with our executives, whether I'm doing it with executives or my college juniors, right? Everyone has this part that they'll say, oh yeah, it was no problem praising. I just had a hard time thanking. It was like I was giving up kind of my ownership of what I've accomplished. Or they had no problem thanking and praising, but asking for help, man, I just can't do it. What we find is that individuals who can exhibit all three of those behaviors, they tend to be able to go into a situation and ask for help comfortably, understand that other people have information they don't, and that they can do a lot of things that are beneficial for building humility.
And those three, again, were asking for help, praising, and thanking?
Yes. Yeah. Those are the exercises I've always used. And they seem to work pretty well in helping people identify where they need to.
Let's test it out right now. Asking for help, praising, and thanking. Which one is hardest for you? I'll go with asking for help would be the hardest one for me of those three.
I can definitely praise. I could definitely thank. Asking for help, and you had started the session with what do I need to learn? It's asking for help from my students. Like, how do you want to do this? Professor, we can do it for you. This is easy. And then they're like, the next thing you know, I've learned. But it's that kind of having to drop down your guard and say, I just have no clue how to do this.
Damon, your turn.
I would say maybe it's thanking only because you could lose sight of how important it is to do that. Yeah. I personally, during this, I like to ask for help. I think you don't need to recreate the wheel. And it's okay to show vulnerability on it. But sometimes I would go with thanking might be something that I got to continue to keep in top of mind.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because actually my feeling is that you're pretty good at that. In fact, my guess is that we're actually probably pretty good at all of these, but that brings up that point, is that sometimes you can't tell. Like, you might feel genuinely like you really might feel good about those things, but are not necessarily being perceived that way. So that, of course, is part of the deal, right?
Yeah, Jared, and I thank you for bringing that up, because humility does have two parts, right? It's how you feel. Like, you can feel really humble. Like, you're walking into every situation with this heart of humility and mindset of humility. But it's how are you coming up to others in that context? And that's really different depending on generational, cultural, whatever it may be. So it's learning the right behaviors to appear that way as well.
We talk about this thing sometimes. This is a really silly example, but when you are presented with an idea that's a compelling idea and it's really got you thinking, it's pretty common to frown. But frowning looks often like you're being critical. And especially if you're in a senior role and you're frowning at an idea, people could perceive it as, well, you don't like the idea. So it's that recommendation to, like, it's not great for you. The generous thing is to actually kind of learn not to frown.
When you, and kind of smile. Like, a hugely different impression around the world. And I grew up, I think, on socialization, right? I grew up as a little girl. If I wasn't smiling, my mom and dad would say, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" Yeah. So I just wanted to look, it's a smile.
Yeah.
But when I started working internationally, I realized that was getting, I was like coming off as a little crazy.
Right. It's been because we show teeth in America. There's a lot of teeth in America.
We're working big on our teeth, right?
Yeah.
So anyhow, it was actually a moment of humility where I did have to relearn the role of a smile. And,
nice. So this leads me to something. It's probably just me, but I'm dying to ask you this question because you have such great, really researched, solid academic background in understanding this, as well as out in the world lived experience. So you really understand what you're talking about. So much of the kind of soft skills training that we came from American universities, where we did the psychological testing on students who could afford to be at those universities. You have that whole weird phenomena, which is industrialized, rich, democratic, that kind of slants all of our perspective on this. So what are your thoughts about there being a Western bias to understanding cultural differences and soft skills training throughout the world?
Yeah, such a good point, Darren. And boy, we could almost spend hours just talking about this. What I began with is what I rely on. So my initial research was on dispositional traits. So personality traits, big five, right? Personality is universal, and behaviors will emerge somewhat culturally specific. But in terms of personality traits, we're all wired in terms of how our bodies handle things like serotonin, dopamine, and the like. Yeah. And those kind of genetic differences, if you will, bubble up, I think, mix and mingle with early life experiences that kind of form our personality traits that are relatively stable. Almost all of the work I do starts from there, because I wanted to, for exactly the reason you named, I wanted to do the things that would work everywhere or be relevant everywhere. So now when I do research, it is with individuals all over the world, in terms of people who are taking assessments. They're not just from the US schools, but they're individuals of all ages, all around the world, all SES, and really trying to make sure that things aren't tilting toward one group or another. And I do my best whenever I'm in talks like these to flag where I think there are cultural differences, even like the humility example. Yeah. There are some ways that plays out differently in different cultures, and we have to be aware of that. Yeah. I do my best. I started on what was core to all of us, and then do my best to try to flag wherever I know that something might be specific.
Yeah, that's great. You seem to be so curious. And I know, Damon, we talk about curiosity as like one of those core things that you really need to embrace and develop. Did that? Oh, that did make it. That's one of your three self-management competencies, curiosity, right?
Absolutely. So curiosity, you think about, if you don't go into a new and novel situation with a heart of curiosity, it's like your flashlight in a dark room. How else are you going to learn about the context that you're in? How else are you going to learn how things are done, or what could be different, or how you're appearing? You know, there's so many reasons it's important. Yeah. So curiosity is important.
Good one to develop.
How has all of this changed with the increase in remote work from the pandemic? You said has it improved or has it made it worse? Because like you said, in the past, sure, we had remote Zoom meetings or team meetings, but you were also in person a lot of times with those different cultures. Now, the majority of this still is remote since the pandemic. So has it made it worse or better? Or what are your thoughts on cultural agility remote?
Yeah, it's made it, so both, it's made it easier, right? We don't have to get on a plane to go to a meeting. So in that way, it's made it easier. But in terms of the cultural issues, it's made it harder because we have fewer cues to clue in on. We have just what we see on a little screen. We don't leave any time at all to get to know one another. So we're removing all of the ways that we become interconnected and build trust and credibility. So we're efficient. So if the task is one that we just need to be exchanging information or content knowledge, great, this is the way to do it. But if it's really building and establishing long-term trust, we're losing a lot of the cultural cues that we would have normally had if we were in person. So I think we're losing some. I'm not turning around this virtual thing, and I think a lot of people love the flexibility of it. I just hope that now we start to get a little bit better at picking up on cultural differences that can happen in the small screen and the Zoom thing.
Yeah.
I was thinking of that because, like you said, it requires you to get even more curious when you're on these Zoom calls to try to pick up those cues because they're not as readily there for you as they would be if you were in person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunate. I have a feeling that if we're in the roles and jobs where trust is critical for success, for effectiveness, for wealth creation, whenever trust is central and core, like it can't happen without it, I have a feeling that face-to-face will come back. I think there's going to be a lot
of I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer when it comes to trust and all of that, to really, for the newer generations coming into the workforce, it'll be hard, I think, to become a great leader if you don't have some of these face-to-face interactions and these learning opportunities as well. Yeah. Remote is great, but I think that there is definitely a need for face-to-face when possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paula, in addition to cultural agility, you are also an expert on essentially like career advice, like how to build a career in a holistic sense about building and managing a career over lifetime. You have your book, Live for a Living. And could you talk to us a little bit about your thoughts when it comes to building a good career?
Yeah. So the premise of Live for a Living is really about self-management of one's career. I think too often we see at the university, we see students like running to get into the university and then working really hard to get that first job. And then everybody gets really passive in the sense that they then wait for their HR department to say, hey, we want you for the next role, or their manager to say, we're going to move you over there, or headhunter to call to say, yep, here we go. We're going to encourage you to get to the next role. What people forget is that in each of those examples, your skills and abilities are benefiting the client organization or your employer. It's not necessarily the next right move for you, although it is flattering, right? Yeah. So I'm trying to take out the, don't be so flattered by being asked to be in a role, but rather really think about you keep owning it. What's the next step that you need in order to keep moving you towards something you view as ideal? And so we spent the front end of the book really talking about how to create or how to identify what would be ideal. And then the middle of the book talking about how to move yourself and own your career all the way through. And then at the end, it's how do you integrate each stage with life priorities, your family, your non-work hobbies. Like,
that sounds great.
What advice do you have for somebody that maybe it's really not their choice? Maybe they were let go and they've decided now is the time that I need to make a career pivot and go in a different direction, but maybe don't have they're a little nervous to make that pivot. What advice do you have for them based off of the skills that they had going into what they've learned in their previous experiences?
Yeah, I would say it's really to take some time, just really do the hard work. Take the time and really try to understand yourself. So many people don't. They don't understand what their natural talents and gifts are. They don't understand necessarily how they best, what are the contexts, what are the situations in which they will work their best? Where do they find a sense of flow? And then the other, what don't they like? So oftentimes we end up keep repeating what feels familiar in the construct of work, as opposed to configuring a lot of self-information into what would be ideal for us. When people start doing that, they start making decisions that surprise others. My co-author, Andy Twilp, talks about making a pretty significant pivot. Everybody expected him to go into like post-business school after his MBA. They expected him to go a certain way. And he went into a much smaller firm doing something that was true to him. When I came out with my PhD, I had a job offer at one of these top business school MBA programs. And I opted to go to a public university doing something else because it was a better fit. So when you start making those types of fit choices, you might not make the choice that's the most logical to the outside world, but it's the right one for you. So that was a long way to say one piece of advice. But
I think it's a great answer, though, because what I hear you saying is don't always go with what you're familiar with, and maybe even reflect on what you feel like your strengths are or your passions that you want to do, and go in that direction.
Absolutely. And that's where we're going to, I think, see people find the greatest level of fulfillment in the careers that they choose.
I think defining what you're passionate about is interesting too, because there's also advice out there that like you can get hung up like with your passion as opposed to do what you're good at. So how do you define, like,
they got to intersect.
Yeah. How does that intersect? And what, I guess I'm saying, what do you think about that advice? Just follow your passion.
Yeah. So I think it's a little short-sighted. I actually would start at a different spot. And that is to say, understand your work centrality. To what extent is a fulfilling career important to you? And we have to honor and respect that. It's not all that important to some people. Like I really don't care. I don't want to manage some kind of big messy. I want to just have a nice paycheck that gets me to be able to do the things I love with people I enjoy. And it doesn't overlap. So we talk a lot about work centrality, work overlap, your career values, and really understanding those. Because once you understand how much of yourself you want to give to this, then you can say, okay, if I really do get this great sense of fulfillment from this sense of accomplishment, some achievement, okay, now let's start talking about where do I want to go? How high, how far, how much do I want to reach? And then it's okay, what's my purpose? What's my interest? Sometimes the things you're passionate about, nobody wants to pay you for.
Right.
Sometimes the things that you're really gifted at, you don't want to do full time, or you just want to keep as a hobby. So it's understanding like the toggle between what's needed out there relative to what you're good at and people will want to pay you to do. It all begins with some self-awareness.
Yeah. So the vision for Paula Calegari with cultural agility, the mission is to bring this out and through Skillify, you're actually you're democratizing this opportunity to become more agile and create a fulfilling career. But in that vision sense, what would the world look like if people could really adopt more of this cultural agility mindset?
It's funny. I think it's just stop with like judging each other around demographic traits and just realizing that we're all embody the socializing agents that we were raised with and that we have experienced throughout our lives. And you know what? Each of us will have a different set of those, and we're all going to come into this, whatever, conversation, situation, interaction with a different lens. And that's cool. That's okay. Like, okay, you know? Like,
yeah.
Everybody's through. We're all a little different. And you know what? It's okay. We can have those conversations and really just respect one another. So maybe if I had said, wow, what would it all look like if this really worked and worked in a kind of a universal way? I think it'd just be respect.
Yeah.
We can all be the same, but we can be respectful.
Sounds good. I'd like to live in that world.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. It is a weird balance, right? Because you're talking about balancing both that we have differences and then we have things that are similar, and being able to live with those kind of opposites at the same time.
Yeah. And it's funny that from a task perspective, so since a lot of your listeners and viewers are leaders, we also have to think about, we're asking people to do different things with that knowledge. Once you see the difference, right? One of the things we talk about with cultural agility is, what do you do with that? So in some cases, what you're doing is adapting, like your colleague who had to adapt her leadership style given the different context she was in. But there's sometimes you have to minimize it. People who are in safety or production or quality assurance or ethics, there's a whole lot of non-negotiables going on there. And it's like, I get it. You see this differently, but you know what? We have a regulation here, or we have a rule here, or we have a whatever. I'm going to have to convince you, motivate you, persuade you to do this in a different way. And then there's this third way, and that's the, look, it's not going to be my way, which is this way, and it's not going to be your way, which is that way, or that other person. It's going to be this thing, and we're going to create this new culture dynamic. It could be the team. It could be us working together, but it's going to be unique to us. Our team's not going to look like that team. We're going to create our own culture. And what we're finding in the research is that great leaders are able to understand when to pull which of those three levers, when to adapt, when to minimize, when to integrate, and they can do it all effectively. So they can read the situation and like pull which one is needed at a given time. That's when you start to see them really flourish in any environment.
I love that you brought that up. You talked about it a little bit. I've heard you talk about it before, this idea that it's not always that you just embrace every single cultural difference. Sometimes you need to push back. And the three levers is a great way to understand a process by which we interact and collaborate with each other.
We're seeing a lot on the phrase adaptability now. Number one competency needed for the future. Number one, we keep hearing adaptability. When you start reading how it's being defined, they're actually not defining adaptability. They're defining this idea of agility, this idea that you have to read the environment, respond as needed.
Nice. Very nice. We've gotten to learn a lot of really cool things about you, Paula. One of the things that we ask people to endure, though, in our podcast is this question. What's something that most people don't know about you? A thing that most people don't know. We had somebody not too long ago share a passion for meteorology that could be all kinds of things. But what's something that a lot of people just don't know about Paula that they might not guess?
Oh my gosh, I am such an open, I've been out there giving every,
it's not coming to you. So it's not like you're a secret Trekkie or I had guessed maybe that you had a passion for trapeze earlier, but nothing like that.
No, but in the 80s, I was a cheerleader, but again, I've talked about that. I'm on
Okay, so I think for a lot of people, that might be surprising. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, right. An embarrassing stretch of my career. Yeah. Or life.
Sure. I admitted to working at Club Med earlier, so I'll go ahead and just own that. We all have things that we've done, right?
And I was Donnie Zuko in Club Med in the late 90s on a family vacation. And not a lot of people know that. So there you go. That's
fun fact.
Yeah. Fun. Paula, how can people get in touch with you?
LinkedIn is usually best. I'm really easy to find if you can spell my last name.
Yes.
So LinkedIn, Instagram, if you can spell my last name, you can find me. So
and that is CaliGiuri. And of course, it'll be right here in the podcast. And any final thoughts for our listeners? Again, some of the stuff that we covered that I thought was just really terrific is some practical recommendations for how to actually be agile. It's what can you actually work on? How can you approach situations in a way that will get you in a more agile place to respond to people and to build those skills? Like you can literally assign yourselves tasks around things like empathy or curiosity or the nine different dimensions. And then we also talked a little bit about career development, things like that. I don't know. Any final thoughts for our listeners before we let you go?
Now, on a really terrific and fulfilling career journey. There's a lot out there. I hope everybody finds it. That's what works for them.
Good. Thanks. It was an absolute honor to have you here. Yeah.
I love that. Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That's it for our podcast today. See you next time.